to perform for anyone who would give me the time of day. We had a lot of fun, my tool belt and I, as I learned all the different aspects of house framing. At one point, my job was to burn all of the trash from the construction site out in the yard. I had this big mound of trash, lumber, and other dross, probably a 10-foot-high fire pile. And I had a smaller brush pile already going, maybe 15 or 20 feet away. I was standing atop the larger, unlit trash pile, splashing about gasoline from a 5-gallon can, because that's how it was done. We were building two houses next to each other, and the two brothers who owned the company were shingling the roofs and racing each other, one on each roof. I would add that they liked me, because as usual, I was a clown, but only just enough a one. I worked hard and cracked wise in acceptable proportion until this particular occurrence. Screaming at them, "Watch me burn, boys! I'm gonna do it!" Like I was gonna light the pile under me, I was laughing my ass off. Then suddenly, I saw that the vapors from the splashing gas had caught the brush pile flames, and the fire jumped onto me and the unlit pile beneath my work boots. The gas can exploded and blew me cleanly off the pile and onto the ground rolling. When the smoke cleared, I had lost a lot of my eyebrows and singed my facial hair, but luckily, that was about it. I wasn't personally on fire, and I hadn't been injured in the fall, but that is how the phrase ended up on my jacket. The brothers not only fired me, but they had the stones to charge me for a new gas can, too. At the time, I was riding a 1979 Yamaha XS1100, a big, fat, brown road motorcycle, and I envisioned "Watch Me Burn" on my jacket on that motorcycle. It meant, "Watch me haul ass out of here," but at the same time it meant, "Hey everybody, just wanted to let you know I'm cool, I smoke weed now." An act of public service, really, because before I had the jacket painted, I don't think people were aware of just how goddamn cool I was. Toward the top of 1995, I found this warehouse space on North Avenue. Rick, the landlord, didn't know quite what to make of me, but I think he liked having a clown around. He rented this big room to me. It was probably 20 by 50 feet, and that was the whole of my domicile. In addition, there were a couple of larger warehouse areas where I built a lot of scenery and had my first real shop. At this point, I had finally amassed the full set of tools for a scenery shop, and for a couple years it became my own tiny factory in the Warholian sense. It was right around the corner from Steppenwolf, where I had been working in some plays, so my warehouse became a safe haven for actors to smoke bongs, basically. Suffice it to say that as far as parties go, there were some pretty good humdingers at the warehouse. Besides the more excellent aspects of warehouse living, there were also some minor downsides, like the 5-minute walk from my space in the very back of the building to the bathroom in the front office, especially late at night, especially in the winter. I found it much more convenient to tinkle off of the roof out my back fire escape door, mainly into the snowdrift on a subroof a few feet below me. This arrangement was perfectly agreeable and downright convenient until the drift melted in the spring and 3 months' worth of pee sat in a warm and pungent puddle beneath the windows I needed to keep open because of the now uncomfortable heat. I knew, thanks to a popular proverb, what to do when life gave me lemons, but in this case, when handed lemonade to begin with, I was at a loss. I did some dumping of bleach and water, and I burned a lot of incense. My time working at Steppenwolf, arguably the best theater company in the country, was incredibly educational. No longer the wild and woolly young Turks who had put Chicago theater on the map along with David Mamet's gang, they'd since become a more august, respected company. They'd grown up, working with a budget in the millions, including some substantial corporate patronage. They had to brush themselves off and sit up a little straighter now. But not too straight. After all, my first show there was A Clockwork Orange. Once again, my beloved Robin McFarquhar was the fight choreographer, and I was his fight captain. Rob Eck was in that show as well, so there were two of us representing our tribal circle. As fond as I am of the respective jib cuts of Robin myself, it was really through our association with Robin that we got cast, because everyone in town wanted to be in A Clockwork Orange. We started rehearsals, and I have to say it was a little eye-opening, because Steppenwolf, in our minds, had been this kick-ass, rock-and-roll, irreverent theater company. But by the time I reached them, they had graduated from their time as dangerous young upstarts, having become a company in early middle age with a big, beautiful new theater building that they had constructed with a great many American dollars, some provided by United Airlines and other generous patrons. I was still yearning for rebellion at every turn, but in hindsight, I'm more understanding of their position, and I now certainly think that it was ballsy of them to even attempt mounting an adaptation of a challenging novel like A Clockwork Orange in the first place. Regardless of my immature craving for insubordination, the one thing I can tell you for certain is that I was damn lucky to be there. Although I ended up working there on 6 or 7 shows over a couple of years with some of the best artists in the country, I never had the chance to shine in a major role. Instead, I performed in more workmanlike ways, filling supporting roles, choreographing fights, making masks, and even once working as a makeup artist. I was 25, and the Steppenwolf founders were all in their mid to late 30s, so they were naturally becoming a little more sedate, while still mounting some of the best plays around. My thirst for experimentation and risk was slaked by other smaller theater companies, where the work could become quite explosive. One such company besides my own was a Red Orchid Theater, whose membership included my pal Mike Shannon. I did a play there with him called The Questioning of Nick, which is a 20-minute play that Arthur Coppett wrote, I believe, to get into Harvard. It's a 3-character play we did with Chicago theater hero Guy Van Swearingen, who was the artistic director of Red Orchid at the time. We did the play 3 times in a row, rotating the parts we played with each retelling. The audience, simply seeing the 3 interpretations, found it fascinating, much in the spirit of Rashomon. Simply by changing our personal interpretations of each role, we altered the audience's point of view as well with each iteration. It was incredibly fun to do, and it was a really fascinating little study in storytelling. To this day, I've never worked with someone on stage with a presence quite like Mike. I'm 43, so he's probably 39, so he was a kid of 19 when I met him. He has such a captivating physical quality about him. In one version of the play, he would wrap his dinner plate hands around my head, as he was a police sergeant and I was a teenage suspect, in the story of a high school basketball star being questioned by a police sergeant and his assistant about allegedly throwing basketball games for payoffs. So when he was the sergeant, he would take my entire head in his hands and speak to me very softly. I couldn't move. I was simultaneously terrified and in love. I have never had a more womb-like experience whilst literally embraced by another actor. I did a production of The Crucible at Steppenwolf for a high school series they produced on their main stage. I was cast as John Proctor, the lead, which was, I believe, the last time I was cast as an actual leading man. It is such a great piece of literature to work on, and if you haven't read it, I highly recommend you do so now. This riveting recording will still be here when you return. Okay, back. Pretty gripping, right? Arthur Miller was not too shabby with the typewriter and the dialogue and the drama and such. How about that Giles Corey, huh? Good shit. The gifted young lady who played Abigail in our production was named Cecilia, and she originally hailed from Mexico. You generally don't want new inter-cast relationships springing up in your play. They should be generally discouraged, as they can tend to rock the boat. However, if there exists the remotest possibility of romance between the actors playing John Proctor and Abigail in your production of The Crucible, then you might as well throw in the towel, because you're doomed. The whole play is rife with an intense, forbidden sexuality between the two characters. So naturally, Cecilia and I started dating. The Defiant Theater was this fun, weirdo, little 1920s Vienna wannabe theater art club that was quite an exciting bacchanal by and large. Ultimately, the pinnacle of my Chicago experience was living on North Avenue in my warehouse and building the set for Ubu Raw. We had always wanted to try this Greek scenery trick called periactoi, which is a set of three-sided pillars, 2 feet wide by 12 feet tall, maybe 12 or 16 of them side by side, so all the front or downstage faces together make one enormous picture, as the upstage wall. The whole set of pillars is rigged to spin together so we could rotate between different scenes. It's also a modern billboard technique, but to execute it writ large like that was so fun and really cheap for the considerable amount of bang it carried. So we had these huge expansive cycloramas that we were all painting together in the warehouse and then rigging into the three-sided pillars. One of them had a trick door in it for a surprise entrance because we loved our scenery tricks. Magical theater scenery like secret doors, revolving turntable stages, or trapdoors in the floor are something I love to see properly used, as they can still make me feel the magic I felt as a child. It's like a ride at Disneyland with a more comfortable seat and better writing. Ubu Raw was, in a way, the superhero movie I've always wanted to make but never had the opportunity to do so. I was in an age then and in the sort of physical condition that playing Aquaman or, let's be honest, Ben Grimm from the Fantastic Four might require. As Pa Ubu, I was in a fat suit with this huge round belly, all in white with a big red target on the belly, and my mask was an old bike helmet with a huge latex mask built over it. The main Ubu masks were made by our incredible artist friend Stephanie Nelson, based on a drawing of the character by Alfred Jarry, who wrote the original Ubu Raw. Her mask for Pa Ubu was this huge head that came to a white point at the top, which folded over to the side like an old-timey nightcap, with these weird walrus eyes and a big mustache, so all you could see of my actual face was my lower lip and chin. Joe's staging, upon an absurd circus of a set designed by Emil Bulos, was a joyful romp into the ridiculous. I made my first entrance on steps that were made by slaves who were holding planks. They would walk in formation and turn the planks into steps, which I would pound up and down. As advertised, much of the movement and line delivery was very kabuki-inspired. In addition, there were vast broadsword and quarterstaff fights, which were incredibly demanding physically. At intermission, it was all I could do to lurch into the alley and smoke a couple cigarettes and pound two beers. I'd just peel out of my fat suit, squat against the wall, and catch my breath, just in time to go back in for round two. I am so very grateful that I had that moment to revel in what turned out to be the greatest strength of my youth, even though I didn't realize it at the time. Even by age 28 or 30, we all began to realize what a key ingredient youth had been in the rigorous performances at our Defiant Theater Company. As young ne'er-do-wells, we were able to give ourselves over to the lifestyle so wholly that we sacrificed so many necessary and practical, i.e. grown-up, parts of our lives. Like, I exclusively drove vehicles with no insurance or registration, because those things cost money, which really could have ended badly when I totaled my motorcycle on the freeway on the way to a performance of A Clockwork Orange, and because it wasn't registered to me and had no plates, I just left it on the side of the highway. So with youth, apparently, came a certain amount of assholery, at least on my part. I had been engaged the day after the motorcycle crash to drive my friend Todd's moving truck to Los Angeles, but I had three ribs out of place and the blood vessels in my eyes had been broken. Todd, his wife, and I determined that I could see plenty well enough to truck their entire life's possessions a mere couple of thousand miles. In deference to my injured state, we did take a slight detour through the mystical town of Sedona, Arizona, where they had a friend named Mindy, who practiced white witchcraft. She laid a poultice on my ribs and cleaned up my energies and whatnot, and it smelled real good in her room, so I was pretty down with a witching, all things considered. We rolled into Los Angeles the next day, and I just looked like a serial killer. At the time, I was cultivating this style, consisting of a pork pie hat, the completely blood-red eyes, a thick dog chain around my neck, old leather combat boots, and these weird sort of Swiss paratrooper red camouflage pants with matching cloth suspenders. I met any intimidation that Hollywood created within me in a full-on Mad Max mode, which is really the way to attack any frightening new terrain. I discovered that there was really not too much to be scared of in L.A. beyond a lot of assholes and maybe some venereal diseases. My final chapter in Chicago was centered around the venerated, unassuming Irish whiskey bar across the street from Steppenwolf by the name of O'Rourke's, now sadly gone. For some reason, the magnanimous proprietor, Jay, took a shine to me and hired me part-time as a bartender. Not only was I a 26-year-old drunk, but he added, "You can give your friends the first pint free." I thought, "You are insane. You effectively just told me to hand out a couple $100 a week to my pals." We had the greatest time at O'Rourke's, the most idyllic of what you might imagine as a smoky, dark pub filled with show folk laughing and dancing, or sometimes railing with all seriousness about the state of affairs surrounding the price of tea in China and so forth. Jay was a very benevolent, avuncular figure who really supported the theater community, which in turn supported his business. He had Tom Waits and Jacques Brel and Nina Simone on the jukebox, one of the best lineups I've ever seen. The pub, after all, is where so much of theater life takes place. Romances are consummated and then torn asunder, theater seasons are planned, plays are cast, and chuckles are plentifully expended. While studying there, I served Albert Finney and Laurie Metcalf, Malkovich and Jessica Lange, and I drank with Keanu. It was the place where I first began to rub elbows with hotshots from the world of film who came to perform in or just see plays at Steppenwolf, which has easily the most knockout ensemble of acting talent assembled this side of the Royal Shakespeare Company. I worked on Buried Child with Gary Sinise and Ethan Hawke, and Sam Shepard came to do some rewrites. Sam slipped me $40 and sent me out for a bottle of Maker's Mark one night, and it took a long time after that for anything in my life to eclipse that instance as the most exciting thing that had ever happened. I guess I still had a lot to learn about bourbon whiskey and about being starstruck, which I'm glad I got out of the way in the shadows of O'Rourke's, before I ever even heard of the blinding lights of a red carpet. I know I have deep gratitude for this time in my life, because whenever I would later think things like, "I miss the prime years of my acting life building fucking scenery. Jesus, goddamn, John Cusack had done 24 films by this point." I know I wouldn't trade anything for the time I had with the Defiant Theater and Chicago Theater in general, easily the most fecund and exciting theater community in the country. What with savory stage roles in The Ugly Man, The Kentucky Cycle, Golden Boy, The Questioning of Nick, and Ubu Raw, I had such a string of good fortune in 1996 that I felt like I might never top this banner year. This, combined with my film work, led me to consider a move to New York or L.A. for the first time. Coming into my late 20s also made me realize that I would eventually want to make a little more of a living wage than my defiant salary of $0 a year was providing. New York had a lot to recommend it, but ultimately all signs were pointing west. In my Chicago circle at that time, moving to L.A. was called pulling the Schwimmer, because David Schwimmer had left his great theater company, which is still one of the greatest, the Looking Glass from Northwestern, Shortly thereafter, he won his life-changing role on Friends. This was completely unfair, of course, as David has always remained a loyal and valuable contributing member of Looking Glass, but you know how people are. Shitty. So that was the flavor of the moment, that we thespians must disdain sitcoms. But I eventually came to realize that Chicago actors make a habit of bad-mouthing both New York and L.A. for many reasons, as a defensive mechanism to assuage their own fears about having to move to one of the coasts and give it a shot. One night at O'Rourke's, when we were both two sheets to the wind, my old pal Pickering pinned me against the wall with his finger and derisively said, "Hey, Nicky, I hear you thinking you're gonna go pull the swimmer." If my mind hadn't been made up by that point, that would have certainly done the trick. I owe Steve a debt of gratitude for spinning me a 238-pound cautionary tale, standing it unsteadily upon 2 feet, and poking its finger into my chest. Carry a handkerchief. My wife and paragon of comeliness, a lady of immense talent with pretty sublime taste who goes by the name of Megan Mullally, likes to tell the story of the first night we ever went to dinner together. We had been rehearsing our play, The Berlin Circle, at the Evidence Room Theater in Los Angeles. We had known each other for only a few weeks, but had become fast friends, with some seed of romance brewing in the fecund incubator that is the backstage area of a live theater. I had been living in the raw basement of some fellow troll-like company members and working piecemeal as a handyman, carpenter, and actor, and so one might accurately have described my circumstance as somewhat down on my luck. I had also been helping to build our new Evidence Room theater space in a warehouse, as well as the stage set for our show, so I'd been working all day in overalls, rehearsing in them, and then, in this instance, wearing them to a nice dinner. I would point out to the ladies and gentlemen of the fashion jury that at this juncture I did possess the wherewithal to change into a clean t-shirt. These were a fine pair of Carhartt canvas overalls, but regardless of their durable quality, Megan seemed to think that they were not appropriate fine dining attire. Especially abhorrent to her for some reason were the phone numbers which I had inked in Sharpie all over the thighs of said breeches. When you're 20 feet up an A-frame ladder hanging lights, you often need to jot down information on the nearest handily available surface. I suppose I didn't help matters any when I pulled up to the table and tucked my napkin into the bib of the overalls. Her aversion to my genteel show of elegance completely baffled me, because I was positive I had seen Jed Clampett execute the exact same nicety on the Beverly Hillbillies, but apparently I was somehow well over the line into the realm of faux pas. With such an auspicious beginning, I am fully astonished and grateful to this day that Megan ever took a chance on me. She has since straightened out my closet considerably, as she has a talent and a taste for choosing things like garments, poodles, houses, art, and novels. Really, anything but overalls. I hastily learned to dummy up and wear the shirts she put on me, and I'll tell you what, if I don't get a compliment on every shirt she's ever upholstered me in, well, I'll eat my hat. Naturally, I retain my Carhartts and other workwear for the wood shop and such, but when I go any place that I might be expected to look decent, civil, or not homeless, I reach for one of her choices and welcome the world's inevitable refrain. "Wow, nice shirt." That said, I do have some strong feelings about the world of fashion. In order to chase the brass ring of prosperity, I feel that a jackass like your author must eschew fashion as much as possible. Definitely allow your significant other to choose your shirt, but leave it there. Jobs that require a suit upset me. They displease me much, as our world is rife with such superficial conformity. As a member of a race of animals who are blithely burning through the natural resources of their beautiful planet, laughing their faces off like beer commercial models as they careen across the water on their jet skis, I am pretty well put off by the amount of attention we monkeys can bestow upon things like bang length and pleated fronts and skirt size and shawl collars. Now, I can comprehend why I need brown shoes and belt for some suits and black for others. I can comprehend it, but that doesn't mean I have to like it. In a grander sense, I'm quite peeved by the customs that we have allowed, even encouraged, to flourish around our collective appearance and hygiene. First of all, at some point we allowed ourselves to become stinky to one another. Animals, mammals in particular, seem to love the musk of their brothers and sisters, a scent so potent that they can actually communicate with one another through the odors they are giving off. We people gave that up centuries ago, and now our natural odor is counterintuitively offensive. This is a failure, people. It's the fallacious part of our human egos that informs us we're better than nature, which keeps us from enjoying the sniffing of one another's crotchal areas. I'm not preaching here, I'm one of us just as much as you are, but I'm always at the ready to try getting more stinky. Additionally, we've somehow determined that men need to shave their faces every day, and now apparently their torsos require denuding as well? How far have we fallen? A hairy chest used to be the actual measure by which a man's virility was determined, and now we are requiring of our men a nubile, naked set of pecs like some prepubescent teenager? If indeed a shot of rot gut puts hair on your chest, why then you'll be required by modern fashion to have it waxed. Whiskers grow as designed by nature, so how can that be bad? They come standard on every model. They're like the weeds of the face, and as we all know, there are some very charismatic weeds in the world of flora, like asparagus. Also, weed is a weed with a pretty solid fan following. Perhaps, as our modern civilization slowly learns to accept the inevitable goodness of ganja, we can also return to the custom of honoring flocculent men. Look, you can shave all you want. Do as you please, I say, but if some of us want to look a little more woolly, then I would also ask you to let us be. I want to forevermore take unkempt as a compliment. Speaking of the pudenda neighborhood, for glory's sake, everybody, what about all this waxing going on down south? Of all the lovingly crafted details sported by Mother Nature's masterpiece, the human form, the pubic bush is easily the cherry on the, well, the pie, I suppose. That curly forest acts as a flag, signaling to the weary traveler, here is a feathery love tick upon which you may rest your weary pikestaff or love clutch. Caressing a mink-like crotch epaulette is one of the most comforting stages in any self-respecting seven-step foreplay strategy. Not to mention, the pubes act as an effective catcher to keep crumbs out of the more sensitive areas when consuming one's post-coital scotch egg. For the love of Mike, bring back the bush. Speaking of, ladies. Ah, beautiful ladies. In order to comply with the implied social regulations, women are required to submit to a much more rigorous program of hygiene than the gents. They shave their legs and armpits and wear meticulously applied paints and powders on their faces in order to appear more attractive, quote unquote. It's a racket. When I see a person without makeup, I think she appears real, like nature made her, which to me is purely beautiful. When a person has applied, even expertly, a full face of makeup, then she appears to me to resemble someone on the cover of a magazine or something manufactured like a doll. Therein lies the rub, methinks, that we as a people have been made to believe that we need to look like these foxy people on billboards and bus posters in order to appear beautiful and thereby find happiness. I am saddened, dear listener, to inform you that this sickness has penetrated our psyches so nefariously that some of the afflicted have taken to bleaching their assholes. If you are worried about what your visitors will think of the window dressing around the orifice where ordure exits your body, then I'm going to go ahead and suggest you turn around. The stuff you want to pay attention to is on the front side. Men and women alike, if you think that altering the tip of your nose with surgery will make you happier, I would suggest you alter something much more malleable than your flesh, like your priorities or your friends. Quit looking in the mirror so much. My two cents. I know this is a clod-like guy opinion, I mean, look at me. But by and large, fashion seems like a huge waste of time and money. A good pair of jeans should last for several years. I don't really give a shit how they hang. They should not pass from favor because their shade of blue is no longer acceptable at the mall, or they don't hug your buns as tightly as they are required to by the cover shots of Caboose magazine. Here is all a jackass like you or me needs to get by fashion-wise. Underwear is a great idea. Nothing is required, but the clever thing about drawers is that they can actually act as a repository for accidental or on purpose discharges from the body and the subsequent stains without ruining the outer pants-like garment. A pants-like garment. Jeans, shorts, overalls, dungarees. Pockets are a must for the storing of your necessaries. Knife, money, tobacco, frogs. String, marbles, bullets. Read your twain for suggested pocket wares. Pants keep the chiggers from your shins. Pants cloak the stained under drawers from the world's prying glance. Obviously, carry a handkerchief. Work boots? A good hat. Chapter 12. Subaru Leavings. In my life, I have left my parents' home in Minooka, Illinois twice, following that grand old American tradition on both occasions by taking my leave in shitty used Subarus, once for college and once to move from Illinois to California. In 1988, I purchased a used Subaru Brat from my friend Joe Stahula, who was in Oklahoma with me at Minooka High School, for $350. I test drove it in a field near his house where we did a lot of donuts and drove through the creek. Kick-ass action? Check. The Brat is a tiny pickup truck that has four-wheel drive and a roll bar. There are two seats in the tiny bed behind the cab facing the rear that have airplane controller joystick-like handles for the passengers to hold on to when traversing terrain like, well, the creek. It's built for fun, the Brat, but it's also practical. A person can fit a full 4x8-foot sheet of plywood in the bed by simply cutting it into 8 conveniently sized smaller pieces. During my freshman year, we once drove it from Champaign to the nearby town of Decatur, Illinois, where Millikan University sits, to see some friends in a production of the Scottish play, Macbeth. We had two guys in the front seat in the tiny little two-seater cab and two guys riding in the back action seats. On the highway, apparently bored, we began to execute a rotation. Everybody moved one seat counterclockwise, with one guy coming in the passenger window, one guy going out by way of the driver's window, etc. Just for fun. At 70 miles an hour on the freeway, it was pretty big goddamn fun. The Brat was a constant location of tomfoolery. In one of Robin McFarquhar's classes, we'd do an exercise where we'd split into pairs, with one person blindfolded and the other guiding him or her around campus. It was called a trust exercise, for obvious reasons. Connected at the hip by this point, Joe Faust and I dutifully tottered to the Brat, whereupon I drove around the quad blindfolded based on Joe's instruction. We got an A in that class, and a slap on the wrist. That rusty and fantastic Subaru Brat ended up being very instrumental in the mischief that Joe Faust and I would wreak among the polite communities of Champaign and Urbana. Sometimes Joe and I would just drive up alongside some pedestrians and shower them with silly string or water balloons, and then drive away, leaving the slightly inconvenienced strangers puzzled at the identities of these hilarious, in their own minds, street clowns. The Brat was the final tool in the kit this young man needed to set off into the big wide world on his own. I'll never forget my mom's reaction to my exit standing in the driveway. As much as my dad is a heroic Atticus Finch-type figure of the Manuka countryside and my life in general, my mom is his equal Lady Atticus counterpart. They're very Ma and Pa Ingalls, raising a family in a garden while maintaining and beautifying a household. She was quietly sweet as honey, and she was the more nurturing or mothering of the two, as mothers often are. She heroically made some of our clothes from scratch while producing meals with such frugality and acumen in the kitchen. For a few dollars a week, she would feed all six of us like kings, all with an air of gentleness and competence. I've never met anyone nicer than my mom, and I've met Donnie and Marie. It's because her own family, the Roberts clan, is so affable, and they all share that same sense of competence. By mastering the implements and their immediate surroundings with determination and humor, they have created a dependability within themselves that then provides us all with the room to breathe and laugh. My mom's mother, Eloise Roberts, or Grandma L, or best of all on the CB radio, the gambler, had a lot to do with my own mom turning out to be such a champion of life and family rearing. With a bit of misbehavior in her own childhood, Grandma L let me know that she generally appreciated a wise ass, encouraging a lot of the silliness that thrived in her grandchildren. Growing up amongst these rock-solid Americans was more valuable to my development and my disposition than any school into which I could have set my muddy boot. My mom, as a result, has such a great sense of humor. I may be romanticizing, but I feel like this vein of humor that has traveled down the years via her farming forebears is a product of the Depression, wherein one could watch an entire year's profits be wiped out with one heavy rainfall. In such an instance, you have the option of either blowing your brains out or making a wisecrack. This family was always looking for the light, for any jape they could find in any unpleasant circumstance, and that sensibility really helped me develop my own sense of humor. I eventually learned that one doesn't want to jack around too much, as you are then regarded as a hindrance, also known as a jack-around, to getting the work done. Bring just enough wit to any given situation to lighten the load with a grin. Our family's humor made the emotional moments that much more poignant then, as I remember my mom in the driveway crying at seeing one of her little ones go traipsing off to a school 2 hours south. Mom and Dad had already gone through this with my sister Lori, a year my senior, but I think that Lori would agree that since I got so much attention, because I demanded so much attention, and because I was the oldest male child, it would leave a different sort of hole in the household, although she would argue that it was actually the hole who was leaving. Despite the fact that Lori could still beat the snot out of me, I was the strongest of the kids in areas like pushing the lawnmower and carrying luggage, not to mention my possessing the most obnoxious voice at the dinner table. Whether one was a fan of my stylings or no, there was no question that family meals would be conducted henceforth in greater silence. It was a very emotional parting for all of us, but my portion was pairing my grief with an excitement at my impending adventure far from the cozy nest. I knew very powerfully then that I needed to set off into the world and try to puzzle out how to become a man. That particular departure took place in the fall of 1988. Some years later, after I had graduated from the U of I and subsequently served my years in the graduate program of Chicago Storefront Theater, it was time for a strikingly similar leaving on a blustery Christmas day in 1996. Having planned for some months to move to Los Angeles, I had found in the newspaper a used 1990 Subaru station wagon for about $750. Rusted out and originally maroon, just like the brat had been, it was jammed with my worldly goods, which consisted of some boots, some jeans, a shitload of cassette tapes, and my tool kit. That was my dowry, I guess, should I ever find a willing rancher to take me to his marriage bed. Traveling with a good set of tools is a great comfort to the carpenter, because he or she knows that no matter where the wind blows him or her, Somebody's gonna need a gazebo, and that means he or she can purchase a sandwich and a pair of Levi's. I had a large burrito pack of goods tied down on top of the wagon as well, wrapped up in ratty old scenic canvas with a papier-mâché boar's head from Ubu Raw strapped on the front. With the portion of gumption I had been served by my mom and dad, I, like so many fools before me, simply thought, well, I reckon I'm driving this thing to California. What the hell? Let's do this. When I had first gone away to college, I knew that the ultimate pinnacle of my career would be to arrive in Chicago and get paid American dollars to act in a play. That seemed, at the time, the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest. Even in Chicago, having summited that particular peak of making a living as a theater professional, during the first 3 years or so, I had no thoughts of ever leaving. At Defiant, we had heard legends of people transplanting a play to L.A. or New York, but such a quest had not been undertaken by anyone in my immediate circle of acquaintance. Eventually, however, a certain wanderlust had crept into my psyche, and I wondered if a jackass like myself might investigate the treasures of the nation's coastal cities. I knew that New York was a town to which an aspiring theater lad might emigrate, but I think I would have been equally as lost in New York as any place else, if not more so. Meanwhile, Los Angeles had been batting her eyelashes at me more and more during my last couple of years in Chicago, like a late-night lady in a bar, seeming more and more attractive with every beer I drank. The harsh difference between New York and Hollywood, in hindsight, was that no one moves to L.A. to get work in the theater. During my last year in Chicago, I did Ubu Raw, The Kentucky Cycle, and The Questioning of Nick, some of the best play productions I've ever been a part of. Little did I realize what a wealthy community I was leaving behind, where I habitually did 5 or 6 plays a year, built sets for 8 others, and choreographed fights for another 3 or 4. I used to love making a list on New Year's Eve of all the shows I'd worked on that year. If a person was willing to live on a slim income, that person could be rich as Croesus in terms of satisfying theater jobs. Only by leaving that time of financial poverty behind me did I realize just how wealthy I had been artistically. I'd also logged my first couple of legit film jobs in my final year. In one of them, a Morgan Freeman Keanu film called Chain Reaction, directed by Andy Davis, I was cast in 2 scenes as Keanu's building super, but I never even got to meet Mr. Freeman. It was batshit crazy to me at the time. I was suddenly in a movie, for real. I was going to be on the screen at the movie theater. My education continued, as I later learned from the film's premiere, that both of my scenes were totally cut out, which is but one of the many harsh lessons we show folk are constantly dealt in this business. I still got my SAG card out of the job, which is a seemingly elusive necessity to finding further opportunities in the film business. I got paid what was then 2 months of carpenter's wages for 2 days of acting work, literally. It wasn't an avenue I was actively pursuing, film work, but all of a sudden I realized that this avenue had some very attractive features to it. Shortly thereafter, I was cast in this Sundance movie directed by Mark Pellington and produced by Tom Garai called Going All the Way, from Dan Wakefield's excellent novel of the same name, with some youngsters like Ben Affleck, Rachel Weisz, Jeremy Davies, and Rose McGowan, all of whom were babies at the time, toddlers anyway. At lunch one day, to give you a sense of where we were chronologically, Ben was talking about how he and a buddy had a script that might get made, which turned out to be Good Will Hunting. In Going All the Way, I played Wilkes Wilkerson, an antagonistic high school buddy of Ben's character with a big mouth. There were more lessons in store for me. Out of my 7 scenes, maybe 4 or 5 were cut from the final film, mainly because Ben had a prosthetic beard in most of the scenes that ended up not looking quite right, so they cut the whole beard story. Yet another class in the School of Hard Knocks, which I continue to attend even now. The film was shot in Indianapolis, and all of the leads had been cast in L.A., but fortunately my part was small enough to cast out of Chicago. I drove with another day player to Indianapolis for our few days of filming. This other fella, Jeff, had done a couple of commercials on location before this, so he taught me about per diem shortly before he cottoned me to what filet mignon was all about, a blessed calling indeed. Wherever you are today, Jeff, I offer you my reverential thanks. This was the first time I had ever heard about, let alone received, a per diem, and I just thought, are you fucking kidding me? I get this great job acting in scenes with amazing actors for this crazily cool director for a very healthy salary, and you also give me extra money? You're worried about if I'm gonna eat? I don't recall what the amount was on that film, but the current minimum amounts for a SAG union shoot on location are breakfast $12, lunch $18, and dinner $30. Some generous productions have just made a clean job of it by giving us $100 a day. Many times on location, I've simply been handed a stack of Ben Franklin's upon landing in town. In 1998, I did a movie in New Orleans, and it was early enough in my career that I was pleasantly surprised when they gave me a rental car. I showed up, and they said, here's your car, and here's a stack of $100 bills. Your per diem is $100 per working day, and you're here for 3 weeks, so here's $2,100 in cash. Now, Jazz Fest was in town, and, oh, it was New Orleans. They tell me I had a very good time. Nice work if you can get it. The Keanu movie was amazing in its own right. I was walking amongst the giant playground of a big-budget action film set around downtown Chicago, although I was a local hire, so no per diem. Seeing how a movie was shot through the fresh eyes of a new employee of said film went a long way toward making me think about that side of the business. These thoughts were further bolstered on Going All the Way, where everybody was super friendly and very encouraging. You should totally move to L.A., they said. You have a great mug. You'll work like crazy. In California, months later, struggling to find my ass with both hands, I was fortunate enough at least to find those same people, remind them of their goddamn encouragement, and then shake them down for a sandwich or a couple of tacos, to which they really had no choice but to generously acquiesce. All of these factors played an important part in my calculations as I pondered the notion of leaving the womb of my Chicago theater family and illogically leaping into the mysterious void of either New York or Los Angeles. In truth, a major source of persuasion was a lower molar I was sporting, which boasted a hole so large I could fit a peppercorn into it. Yes, that was handy on long hikes, but not the healthiest place to stash extra spices. This made the promise of dental insurance through SAG a tasty-looking carrot indeed, leading me west. Another substantial factor at the time was my pretty serious relationship with a young lady from Tampico, Mexico. My girlfriend Cecilia said, and I quote, "Motherfucker, I'm a skinny Mexican girl. I'm not moving where it snows. We're going where it's sunny." After weighing all of the pros and cons and applying logic as carefully as possible, I guess that settled it. It's truly amazing what a woman can accomplish when she's chilly. I put what small wheels I had access to in motion and set everything up. I had lined up a couple of minor jobs in L.A. and laid some groundwork for places to live, all very tenuous plans, but the beginnings of a new life nonetheless. It was about this time that Cecilia fully flipped out about the serious reality of our moving to another city together. A pretty big step that, as it turned out, she was not ready to take. All of a sudden, she disappeared. Cecilia sort of dropped out of my life and then vanished farther from the entire city. None of her friends knew where she had evaporated to until she turned up back in Mexico, where I believe she's gone on to become a Mexican movie star. Based on my eventual ability, or lack thereof, to provide, or even just contribute to our domestic comfort in Los Angeles, I think she and I would agree that she made the right call. By now, I've driven between L.A. and Chicago so many times that I could start a courier business. The cheapest way to do it back in the day was a service called Drive-Away Cars. Please heed this warning, and don't ever use a service like this. Why not, you might ask? It's much more reasonably priced than having my car shipped. Here's why. You'll get a fucking stoned asshole like me driving your car across the country. They give your car to me, or any asswipe with a license, and all I have to do is put gas in it and leave a deposit of about $150, at least in the 90s. I actually totaled somebody's car once. I was driving from Chicago to L.A. on one of maybe six such trips in a driveaway, and I was hauling ass through Colorado in the winter. I was driving through the Rockies at about 3 a.m. I was cranking the music, and of course I was baked. Now, let me make something clear. The Offermans and the Robertses are, as a rule, great drivers. A lot of our livelihoods have revolved around driving domestic and industrial vehicles. No exception, I spent years calmly learning to back up a truck loaded with tons of asphalt or a tractor with a wagon load of corn, and so I am a very dependable driver. Having established this, however, sleep deprivation, a preponderance of marijuana, and it's being 3 in the morning may have slightly hampered my dependability, resulting in my hitting some ice on a mountain highway and slowly spinning out of control. I turned down Bone Machine and thought, okay, friend, we've had a fine run, we've done some good shit, and now it's over. Fortunately for this idiot, instead of one of the cliff-top drop-offs that much of this mountainous route rides alongside, there was a huge, sheer concrete wall rising up on the right shoulder. I gently slammed into it and slid abrasively along it for maybe 100 yards. I slowed to a sparky halt, checked my drawers for effluvia, and realized the car was still running. Great, I thought. But when I got out to survey the damage, the entire passenger side of the car was, well, gone. It was just rubbed off, to put it simply. I thought, well, all right. I completed the drive to Los Angeles and turned the car in to the drive-away company. I was pretty nervous, naturally, because I had never really read the shit that I signed when I picked up the car. Was I on the hook for this fucking thing? I managed to keep my cool when I learned that no, they were covered. They kept my $150, but that was it. I walked out of their front door and just played it real smooth until I got about a couple of blocks away, whereupon I sat on a bus bench and wept for relief. This seems like a good juncture at which to reiterate, do not entrust your car to a drive-away service. This exodus at the end of 1996 was about 8 years after the original collegiate Subaru leaving. I'd spent 4 years in Chicago, so rich and full that it felt like a decade. When my parents first came to see my plays down at school, they really enjoyed them, despite my own usually underwhelming casting. I think they were just relieved that I was allowed on stage in the first place. They would generally come away terribly impressed with the production values, which were of a quality that was indeed quite professional. They were always very supportive, which was never lost on me, because there was no small amount of faith involved. When I got to Chicago and they saw me working at actual professional theaters, they said, "Wow, okay, you're making $9,000 a year, and that's tough, but you're resilient, you're doing okay, and we support you." Which meant more to me than they knew. Then my dad would slip me $80, which I'm sure he didn't have to spare. Those are the types of people whose level I'm trying to live just halfway up to every day. They saw everything I did in Chicago, which was a pretty intense calendar to maintain from Manuka, and they were close enough to Chicago that I was always able to bring friends home for dinner, which was like vacationing from Gotham to an episode of the Andy Griffith Show. By that time, I had a couple of tattoos and had become very hedonistic. I was very interested in flexing my artistic muscles and letting everyone in Manuka know that I was an artist and I was different, that I was a nonconformist. They didn't particularly give a shit. It was more like peacocking that I needed to do for myself to sort of cut myself loose from the security of my family and town. By the time I decided to move to Los Angeles, I don't think anybody was too surprised. I had been traveling up this slight incline of better and better gigs at bigger and bigger theaters, so making the admittedly daunting move to a coast was only natural. It wasn't the nicest thing to do, looking back, driving 2,000 miles directly away from my family on Christmas, but I had always had a flair for the dramatic, and I wanted to lend to the occasion a sense of the vital impending sea change I sensed occurring within me. Given the time of year, it was certainly a chilly leaving. Same driveway as 1988, same mom and dad. My dad's funny. He's one of those classic guys who keep their emotions tucked deep inside, although he's improved leaps and bounds over my lifetime. He'll now end a phone call with, "We love you," but he won't say, "I love you." He doesn't have to say shit. I know he loves me. For Christ's sake, he and my mom have made their lives nothing if not a graceful demonstration of their love for their four kids. He's always been very humorously taciturn, but now I'm tickled to report that he hugs me in moments where we used to shake hands. My mom handled that leaving with a teary stoicism, and I'll always remember the gratitude I felt toward her and Dad as I drove west across Illinois' wide rolling river valleys, the darkness dotted with sporadic farms that had been properly bedecked with Christmas lights. Parents have to weather a lot of fear throughout the normal rearing of a child, and I can't imagine the guts it took for my folks to stand on the chilly front porch and watch me putter away down Osceola Street in a rusty Subaru, with a mightily betusked boar's face at the prow, connecting snowflakes like a Dada figurehead, pointing toward St. Louis, and an even greater unknown beyond. Discern your ass from a hole in the ground. My dad is a map guy. While I was growing up, we as a family drove the 12 or so hours to our fishing cabin every year in Minnesota, and every year we took a different route through northern Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, sometimes veering into Iowa, Michigan's Upper Peninsula, or the Dakotas on side trips. He loved getting out his collection of maps and scrutinizing them. He would say to me, "Well, Jasper, let's go this way through Verndale, Bluegrass, and Hubbard, and we'll miss the speed trap north of Wadena." Using methods like this, we discovered treasures over the years that became tradition, like stopping at Grandma Schmerker's restaurant for her excellent pie. I loved the power that those maps and my dad's mastery of them gave us. "Going south, we can stay in La Crosse. We'll pick up some cheese curds, and the next day we'll try to make it home without traveling on an interstate or through a town of more than 1,000 people. We almost made it last year, but I got caught driving into Sominock when your mom nodded off and I lost my navigator. A 5.5-hour ride happily took us 10 hours. To me, this ability is akin to the tying of a knot, the building of a fire, or the changing of a flat tire. Maps are easily as valuable as any other tool, but in this day and age, I've been very disturbed to see people neglect their maps and instead completely depend on their GPS units. When global positioning systems began to become prevalent in cars, what with the talking instructions and video game-like street scroll, I grew disturbed. Now we have GPS and maps on our phones, with all kinds of extra information like traffic conditions and the location of the nearest Pinkberry. Now hold up. These developments are great, no question. I mean, I can ask my phone device to tell me where the barbecue joints are, as well as what people think of the brisket at each of them. Nothing wrong with that. What does unnerve me, however, is the technique with which I employ this information. I often use the handy maps function on my phone, but I still do it like my dad, meaning I suss out the route and situation before I go. What I cannot allow myself to do is acquiesce to being led by the nose to my destination by a computer. I'll decide where to turn, thanks. Surely you all have been through the experience at least once of your computer giving you completely asinine directions because it simply looks for the biggest arteries for driving through an area, giving no consideration to context or mitigating circumstances. Even if it did, which I'm sure one day they will, I just can't shake the feeling that the more we people depend, infant-like, upon such coddling, the weaker we grow in character. Once we begin to depend on the sugar teat of the GPS to change our diapers and drop us off at whatever destination we require, then we might as well just climb back into the stroller and caterwaul until Mommy brings us a cookie.